everyone. Thank you for coming out today. My name is Jennifer Brown, and I'm really excited to be introducing these fabulous art authors. Historical fiction transports us to the past. History provides the framework for the author, who then starts to fill it in with facts and with the research that they do, but they enhance it with their imagination, creating a really full picture of something that we just don't know all the details for. Writers of alternative fiction have an even harder task because they first have to start with this very detailed world building and then ask, what if? They change history to create novels full of suspense and fantasy and elements from other worlds. Today we're going to be reimagining history. Catherine Arden will ask us, what if a young woman in medieval Russia is aided by the Frost King of fairy tales to protect Moscow? P. DeJelly Clark asks, what if post-Civil War New Orleans was filled with Orishan magic and sky smugglers? Jordy Rosenberg asks, what if thief and jailbreaker Jack Shepherd was trans, living in a multicultural, genderqueer 18th century London? Each of these authors will be reading from their novels today, Catherine's The Girl in the Tower, DeJelly's The Black God's Drum, and Jordy's The Confessions of the Fox. All three of these amazing books are going to be for sale afterwards at the table right outside, and all three will be here to personally sign your books, and they'll be sitting at the table right by the sales. Our first reader today is going to be Catherine Arden. Catherine is the author of the Winter Night Trilogy that reimagines myth and being a woman in medieval Russia as she laces her history with fairy tales. The Bear and the Nightingale is the first book in the series, and this year we saw the publication of her second book, The Girl in the Tower. The third book, The Winter of the Witch, will be out this January. She also has a middle grade book which debuted last month called Small Spaces. Catherine earned dual degrees in French and Russian from Middlebury College, and during that time spent 2 years living in Moscow. While her original goal was to become a diplomat, after graduation she took a hard left, moved to Hawaii, and went to work on a macadamia nut farm. That's where she started writing the book that became The Bear and the Nightingale. So we're going to have Catherine come up and read from The Girl in the Tower, which received starred reviews from Publishers Weekly and Booklist. Kirk has called it a compelling, fast-moving story that grounds fantasy elements in a fascinating period of Russian history. Please welcome Catherine Arden.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. I'm so excited to be here. As you can probably hear from my voice, I am getting over a cold, and my voice is very chancy. So I'm going to begin to read and continue to read. If I suddenly stop and ask Jennifer to read for me, that might happen. So we're going to see how it goes. This book and my entire Winter Night trilogy was the result of, as Jennifer put it, a hard left. As one can say, I was a Russian major. I was really into the history and culture of Russia in college, and I intended to be an interpreter or a diplomat or really have a serious career. And but I graduated, and I was so tired of being cold. I'd been in Moscow for 2 years. I'd been in Hawaii. I'd been in Vermont for three. So it was just a very cold environment. So I asked myself, where is it not cold? And I moved to Hawaii and worked on a farm. My parents were very excited for this life choice, but I did, and started writing The Bear and the Nightingale, which is obviously a not in the least tropical novel. It's a book set in medieval Russia, the 14th century, in Muscovy, so the area in around Moscow, and it's the story of a girl named Vasilisa who has the ability to see the household spirits of Russian folklore. And to talk to them. And this ability kind of like is both a blessing and a curse, and it really shapes the course of her life. And I just wanted to read actually just the first chapter of The Bear and the Nightingale, which is set before the main character's birth. But in it, her family is sitting around a fire in wintertime telling a fairy tale to each other. And this opening chapter was kind of my way of finding a way from history into myth, because you have a family in a historical Russian setting telling a fairy tale, which then in subsequent chapters grows to mix with and take over the history. So the books really are a mingling of Russian history and then Russian folklore and fairy tales. So I'm going to read. Again, I have my water. I have taken many cough drops. Hopefully it all works out, but we'll see. No promises. If I make a weird squeaking noise, it's because my voice just died. So we're going to, everyone cross your fingers. Chapter 1, Frost. It was late winter in northern Rus, the air sullen with wet that was neither rain nor snow. The brilliant February landscape had given way to the dreary gray of March, and the household of Pyotr Vladimirovich were all sniffling from the damp and thin from 6 weeks fasting on black bread and fermented cabbage. But no one was thinking of chauvelins or runny noses or even wistfully of porridge and roast meats, for Dunya was to tell a story. That evening, the old lady sat in the best place for talking, in the kitchen, on the wooden bench beside the oven. This oven was a massive affair, built of fired clay, taller than a man, and large enough that all four of Pyotr Vladimirovich's children could have fit easily inside. The flat top served as a sleeping platform. Its innards cooked their food, heated their kitchen, and made steam baths for the sick. "What tale will you have tonight?" Dunya inquired, enjoying the fire at her back. Pyotr's children sat before her, perched on stools. They all loved stories, even the second son, Sasha, who was a self-consciously devout child and would have insisted, had anyone asked him, that he preferred to pass the evening in prayer. But the church was cold, the sleet outside unrelenting. Sasha had thrust his head out of doors, gotten a face full of wet, and retired, vanquished, to a stool a little apart from the others, where he sat, affecting an expression of pious indifference. The others set up a clamor on hearing Dunya's question. "Finis the falcon," they cried. "Ivan and the gray wolf! Firebird! Firebird!" Little Alyosha stood on his stool and waved his arms, the better to be heard over his bigger siblings, and Pyotr's boarhound raised its big, scarred head at the commotion. But before Dunya could answer, the outer door clattered open, and there came a roar from the storm without. A woman appeared in the doorway, shaking the wet from her long hair. Her face glowed with the chill, but she was thinner than even her children. The fire cast shadows in the hollows of cheek and throat and temple. Her deep-set eyes threw back the firelight. She stooped and seized Alyosha in her arms. The child squealed in delight. "Mother," he cried, "Matushka." Marina Ivanovna sank onto her stool, drawing it near the blaze. Alyosha, still clasped in her arms, wound both fists around her braid. She trembled, though it was not obvious under her heavy clothes. "Pray the wretched you delivers tonight," she said. "Otherwise, I fear, we shall never see your father again. Are you telling stories, Dunya?" "If we might have quiet," said the old lady tartly. She'd been Marina's nurse, too, long ago. "I'll have a story," said Marina at once. Her tone was light, but her eyes were dark. Dunya gave her a sharp glance. The wind sobbed outside. "Tell the story of frost, Dunyushka. Tell us of the frost demon, the winter king Karachun. He is abroad tonight and angry at the thaw." Dunya hesitated. The elder children looked at each other. In Russian, frost was called Moroska, the demon of winter. But long ago, the people called him Karachun, the death god. Under that name, he was king of Black Midwinter, who came for bad children and froze them in the night. It was an ill-omened word, and unlucky to speak it while he still held the land in his grip. Marina was holding her son very tightly. Alyosha squirmed and tugged his mother's braid. "Very well," said Dunya, after a moment's hesitation. "I shall tell the story of Morozka, of his kindness and his cruelty." She put a slight emphasis on this name, the safe name that could not bring them ill luck. Marina smiled sardonically and untangled her son's hands. None of the others made any protest, though they had heard the story many times before. In Dunya's rich, precise voice, it could not fail to delight. "In a certain princedom," began Dunya. She paused and fixed a quelling eye upon Alyosha, who was squealing like a bat and bouncing in his mother's arms. "Hush," said Marina, and handed him the end of her braid again to play with. "In a certain princedom," the old lady repeated with dignity, "there lived a peasant who had a beautiful daughter.
I can try.
Go for it.
All right. Sorry, guys. Almost made it. So I thought I was over my cold. And then reading makes it really hard. Sorry, what? Oh, great. Actually, if that's the case, I might just stop.
Thank you.
Sorry, guys.
Next up, we have P. Jali Clark, a writer of speculative fiction that explores African-American and Afro-Caribbean magic and mythology. His short stories have been published in Daily Science Fiction, Everyday Fiction, Heroic Fantasy Quarterly, Tor.com, and the anthologies Griots 1 and 2, Steamfunk, Best of Heroic Fantasy Quarterly, Myriad Lands, and Hidden Youth. He is also a historian whose work focuses on slavery and emancipation in the Atlantic region. He'll be reading today from his book, The Black God's Drums, which populates 19th century New Orleans with airships, Haitian sky smugglers, and powerful Orisha magic. The novella received starred reviews from Kirkus and Publishers Weekly. Kirkus said, "Clark employs fervent, emotive prose to construct an elaborate world populated by diverse, complex people. The story is thrillingly original and will enthrall fans of alternate histories." Let's hear it for Dejali.
Hello, everyone. So, managed to make it in from Hartford, where I had to endure both a marathon. Hartford has a marathon. It took me 2 hours to get out of my neighborhood. And then the wonderful drive here on the turnpike. So, glad to be here today to read from you. So, today I'm going to read from the novella, The Black God's Drums, which has this wonderful cover. Every time I look at it, I say this should be a poster somewhere. For this art. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to start off the story somewhere a few pages in rather than at the beginning, and I'll set it up for you a bit. My novella is set in an alternate 1880s New Orleans where the end results of the Haitian Revolution has played out differently than in our own history, leaving us with a world of airships, steam power, and the United States still gripped by civil war. We pick up with our protagonist, Creeper, who, overhearing some interesting conversation about a Haitian weapon codenamed the Black God's Drums, has arrived at the Bordello Charouge to barter the information. I should mention an African goddess also takes up residence in Creeper's head. So, picking up on page 19. Charouge was built to look like free New Orleans. It lets in men of any color and offers women just the same. Big Dutch gals, scarlet-haired Irish, dark senoritas, midnight black Senegalese. And like New Orleans, Charouge is neutral territory. Where else can you find Frenchy corsairs making all nice with British jacktars? There's Prussians, New Mexicans, Grand Colombians, even some Californians in their peculiar Russian dress. I count about a dozen black men, all showy and boisterous, Haitians by the looks of it, all gussied up in blue and red uniforms. I pick through the crowd, searching for one face in particular, my eyes fixed instead on some men sitting in a corner and drinking quietly, all in familiar dull faded gray uniforms with the Southern Cross battle flag on their sleeves, the words CSA inscribed beneath in red stitching, Confederate States soldiers, Air Force by the badges on their shoulders. My heart thumps as I wonder if they're the same ones from the other night in my alcove. Pretty certain no one saw me, but still, I walk the other way, keeping a good bit of distance between us. Funny to find Confederates in here anyway, what with all this open miscegenation. They keep to themselves, their eyes wandering every now and again to a knot of loud-talking officers in unmistakable dark Union blue, New York Bowery boys by those rough accents and their sheer bawdiness. Any other day, these allies and enemies might be at each other's throats, but tonight they share the same space and mind their manners, because this is New Orleans, one of the few non-aligned territories in the now broken United States. New Orleans has been free now going on more than two decades, ever since the slave uprising in that first year of the war. Caught the Confederates by surprise. They got scared. They let the free colored militias join up to help put it down. Only the militias switched over to the slaves, and both of them took the city. After that, Union ships and troops came in and got into one big battle with the Confederates. It was them two that burned old Algiers. New Orleans hunkered down and waited it out. Finally, the Haitians and Brits and Frenchies sent their airships to stop the fighting. Truce was signed, making New Orleans a neutral and open port. Free colored men tried to cheat the slaves soon after, hoping to put them back on the plantations. But when it looked like another uprising was brewing, they passed emancipation real quick. A council now runs New Orleans today, made up of ex-slaves, mulattoes, and white business folk. Brits, Frenchies, and Haitians patrol our harbors and skies to keep the peace. Confederates and the Union ain't had a big tussle in 15 years, not since the armistice of Third Antietam. But if that war ever starts back up, New Orleans is going to find herself right in the middle of it again. Folks say that's why we live every day chasing the good times, because you never know when the bad might come. God almighty! I look up to find a round, splotchy-faced Scotsman in a milk-white suit pointing a thick forefinger at me. Two plump octoroons hang off his arms, with piled-up hair and red crescent moons on their cheeks, wearing nothing but frilly pink corsets and black-striped stockings. Lad's too young to be here, do you think? He protests to no one in particular. Not a lad, I mutter, pulling off my cap to reveal a thick halo of black hair and a nut-brown face. The Scotsman's eyes widen, then narrow hungrily. Rum and wine got his face as ruddy as his side whiskers. How much for the wee one, he asked aloud. I think he's joking. Maybe. Or you don't. There's a rumbling thunder in my ear. She's protective like that. Too young for you, sir, another voice puts in sternly, and not for sale. I turn to find a woman striding down a set of stairs towards us, her hand lightly touching the wooden banister. She'd be tall even without the evening heels, with black skin and hair turned a dark smoky gray. Her face is striking, as beautiful as a painting I once seen of the Queen of Sheba. She moves like she's walking on water, the roomy skirts of her ruffled blue dress swishing about her legs in waves. In my head, Oya's anger settles, and she starts up another song about her sister, who tricked her from her throne under the sea. Good evening, Madame Dioff, the Scotsman greets her, stumbling into a bow that almost topples him. I meant no offense. The proprietor of Charouge blinks once before smiling. I'm always envious when I look into those black eyes, like what I imagine the deepest part of the sea must look like. Mine are murky as swamp water, a plain muddy brown. No offense taken, sir, she croons in her African accent. Have you tried the special whiskey I've had shipped in from a distillery in your native country, a place called Orkney? Compliments of the house for you, sir. The Scotsman's face lights up, and he begins to babble on excitedly about having family from this Orkney, forgetting I'm even there. Madame Diorf listens politely. Then at her nod, the Scotsman is pulled away by his escorts, their hips swaying with loose flesh that seems to push him along between them. She promptly turns her attention to me, showing an appraising eye. Little creeping vine, what brings you here tonight? It's just creeper, Madame Diorf, I respond. The older woman grimaces. Manger, I prefer the name your mother gave you, Jacqueline. She runs her fingers through my unkempt hair and tugs at the too big brown coat on my small frame. Or your scowl's as deep as I do. We don't like being fidgeted with. This hair could use braiding. And what is all this? Where did you get those ridiculous trousers? Do you want to be mistaken for a boy? I pull away, putting my cap back on and tucking my hair beneath. On the streets, better people make that mistake, I say. Madame Diorf puts on a severe frown. Damn African, even that's beautiful. You aren't out there running with those guilds, are you? She asks. Gangs of thieves and worse. I don't have nothing to do with any guilds, I retort, somewhat offended, as if I take up dressing up like one of those clowns. Madame Diorf looks me over skeptically. Then that beautiful face softens. She leans down, smelling sweet like honey and jasmine. I get dizzy in the haze of her. You have no need to stay on the streets, Jacqueline, she reminds. Your mother was like my own daughter. Enough schools in the city to take you in. Tried that already, I shoot back. Those girls hold up their noses around a Pitien's daughter. Madame Diorf stands up and lets out a string of curses in her mix of Creole and African talk. It's impressive enough to raise my eyebrows. What nerve, she huffs. Mother's just two steps out of chains and they're putting on airs. She pats my head again, then runs the back of her long fingers across my cheek. Well, I'll have one of the girls set up a bath for you. Have them braid your hair at least, yes? Get some proper clothes on you too. And stay and take some food. To Makom Kaku, put some fat on those bones. By the time I'm led to a kitchen table in the back of the house, I've been freshly soaped, scrubbed, and washed, and had my hair tied down in thick braids. Kept my own clothes, though. No matter what Madame Diorf think, dresses don't do me no good on the street. I settled down into a chair and busy myself licking grease off my fingers as I pull meat from a bit of fried pork. Oya's disappointed there's no hen. I stay away from the roast mutton, though, which the goddess abhors. Eat that, and she'll have me bringing it up back up half the night. From where I sit, I can see everything in the main room. I watch all the cavorting and carrying on as the women of Shahrood smile, wink, laugh, and wiggle every bit of money from their customers, who willingly hand it over. Whole lot of those men gonna have lighter pockets by the end of the night, if not plain empty. They may not know it, but as soon as they walked in here, they never had a chance. The group I'm expecting has to be coming. Got it on good information they would be here. Just need to bide my time. My doubts are still nagging me when they finally push through the door. I sit up squinting to make sure. No doubt about it, that's them. The first one is a trim, dark-skinned man with long hair like a Choctaw. But he's a Hindu, I can tell. Those other Indians from the Far East. More than a few of the women glance at his pretty face. And he flashes back a smile that makes even me blush. Mercy, didn't even know men could have eyelashes that long. At his side is a tall, broad black man with a shadowy beard peppered over with white and a serious set face. The old-time blue military jacket with gold epaulets marks him as a Haitian. His countrymen in the room raise their drinks in salute, and he answers with a deep nod, his stone face unchanging. Behind the man are two more figures. One is the biggest Chinaman I ever put eyes on, wearing a tall, wide-brimmed tan cowboy hat of all things and long matching frock coat. The other, she turns out to be exactly who I came all this way to see. And I'm going to stop there, because you can read the rest.
I think he's a little bit taller than I am. Our final reader for tonight, or today, is Jordy Rosenberg, who has written Confessions of the Fox, which is a New York Times Editor's Choice selection and was also longlisted for the Center of Fiction First Novel Prize. It received starred reviews from Publishers Weekly, Kirkus Reviews, and Booklist. Jordy is a professor of 18th century literature, gender and sexuality studies, and critical theory at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, and he lives part-time in New York and part-time in Northampton. He'll be reading from Confessions of the Fox, which is simultaneously a genderqueer reimagining of the legendary 18th century outlaw Jack Sheppard, who's familiar to many of us through Threepenny Opera, and a satire of modern-day academia. Publishers Weekly said, Confessions of the Fox juxtaposes queer and trans theory, heroic romance, post-colonial analysis, and speculative fiction. Jordy?
Okay, thank you. Thanks to everyone for coming out, and thanks to the Boston Book Festival for having me. I just drove 8 hours back from another reading that had like three people at it, and so I thought, well, this also will have like three people at it, and it'll be fine, but it's not the case. Anyway, thanks for coming out. Thank you for describing the book, so I don't really have to, because I'm going to be reading from the middle of the book. So all you really need to know is that the structure of the book is that there is this 18th century found manuscript. Most of the book is about a real-life 18th century prison break artist named Jack Sheppard, and a scholar in the present, a transgender professor at a demoralized, defunded Research One university somewhere in Western Massachusetts, finds this manuscript when they're emptying out the library. They're selling all the books from the library at this university to make way for a fancy dining commons for the upper echelon administrators. I'm sorry if there are any upper echelon administrators here tonight. In the book, these are not the heroes. Anyway, so the transgender professor finds this manuscript, and he's footnoting it. So it's basically a body text with footnotes throughout, and he's trying to figure out if maybe this prison break artist was also transgender. His footnotes start getting more and more unhinged. If you've read like Nabokov's Pale Fire, I'm not trying to flatter myself, but it's just a similar vibe where you start to realize the footnoter is maybe a little bit unhinged. So I'm going to read you a footnote that is where he's stopped footnoting the manuscript really entirely and started just ranting about resonances that he feels are there between his own life and the manuscript. And the last thing you need to know is he's going to make reference at one point to an epigraph. That's from John Donne, and it's the epigraph to the found manuscript. And the reason why I chose this section is that it's sort of where he develops a passion for history as a political orientation or a reimagining of what if, you know, a reimagining of dominant narratives. And the final thing is that this is a little dirty, so if that will trouble you, you may leave. Okay, so he just cuts in. Speaking of revolutionaries and love, I suppose it's about time to tell you about her, my ex. His ex has nothing to do with the manuscript he's footnoting. Anyway, my ex. Our first date was technically our second date, but it was the first one I could remember. On that date, which was either the first or the second, depending on how drunk you were at the first, my ex spent the entire evening grilling me about world history, current affairs, and the hidden stakes of seemingly innocuous state-level legislation. It was clear that she was in possession of the answers, whereas I had fumbled my way into a decent but unglorious position as a literature professor at the flagship campus of a demoralized and floundering public institution. It was a night of being endlessly harangued by a beautiful woman, not unpleasant, but a bit exhausting. She had asked me if I wanted children. I shrugged, but it was a shrug of kind of, yeah, which she had opinions about too, something to do with the narcissism of how all our hopes and dreams for futurity had been funneled into the project of children, mini reproductions of the self, she called them. Her point was, what happened to throwing your hat in the ring with masses of people who you didn't and couldn't know, who would never know you by name, but towards whose better good you would devote yourself? I'm talking about the future of all of us, she said, not just some little family unit. I realized then she was handing me something bigger than her, me, and a kid. And we both knew that it was practically a crime to be childless in this day and age, which perhaps accounted for why she suggested we go to the Villa Papery Lounge, a restaurant I was quite sure had been closed for decades, vines growing over its gray shingled face in that inauspicious bend in the road on Route 17. It wasn't closed, but it wasn't exactly open either. What she was offering me would involve a sacrifice of a desire for the family, but I was getting the impression that the payoff would be huge. Revolutionaries, comrades, lovers. She played an old Smiths song on her phone. I won't sing this line. Yes, but this is from the Smiths. Yes, we may be hidden by rags, but we've something they'll never have, she crooned. And then, if they dare touch a hair on your head, I'll fight to the last breath. Well, I was sunk. This whole time I'd been trying to imagine being a parent, and here I was being offered a partner. We were back at my place by then. I was getting kind of drunk off old granddad bourbon. She was sitting on that old desk of my grandmother's, the only thing she left me and my only inheritance in the whole world. Her ass was on my inheritance. This felt appropriate. Time got extremely slow. She was wearing this black pencil skirt. It had a small pull near the waist. Gray thigh-high stockings. Her eyes were bright and dark. I looked at her for some time. She opened her legs a bit, twitched them open, really. I caught my breath audibly. Oh my God, she said, you're such a lesbian. She didn't mean it cruelly, and she didn't mean I wasn't passing as a cis man either, although since according to her we had fucked the night before, she knew exactly how un-cis I was. She meant that she saw something about the quality of my desire, that I could feel her before I touched her, and that this was part of what it meant to be, or to have been, before my tits became the property of the California Municipal Waste Department, a lesbian. That a woman moving the line of sight could have an effect that was total, atmospheric, that you could be hesitant and capable and not interested in establishing a line between touching and seeing, and you would indulge a dead love, dead in the eyes of the world and valueless, a love that choked and burdened the mind, that might even be the very foundation of melancholy and despair. But oh, reader, looking at a woman, you really get a feel for the way that fire is a phenomenon of touch. And my point is, if you have ever been a lesbian, you will not even have to touch a woman to know that. But I did touch her. We fucked for what I was told was the second time, and this time it was the fuck you can never get away from. She let me see her in all her historicity, all her ages at once, her before. A cold house on the edge of a field she had not been cared for. Let's just leave it at that. She had hidden in the house's corners, taught herself Marx, Mao, and all the revolutionaries in a drafty wood-paneled addition that poked like a bunion off the main frame. By day, she was a high school girl, learning how to draw the interior structure of combines and backhoes. In her own time, she was slowly becoming the woman who had come to straddle my hips with my cock still inside her, looking down at me, inscribing me, casting my body anew, saying, "There's something wrong with your political worldview. I can fix it." I don't want to dwell on what happened. Everything ends. Who knows why? I mean, she was forever being pursued. Ex-boyfriends, potential new boyfriends, persistent motherfuckers. Was everyone in this world trying to take care of this woman? I couldn't be one of several, though I tried. You, if you're reading this, know I did. Well, so that's one big why. There were others, though. But I'm not going down that road, because I'm reminded of the epigraph to this book. Love's mysteries in souls do grow, but yet the body is his book. And Dunn's point was this. When a woman touches you, when she recasts your body in the flame of love, that fire is a spark thrown off a much larger blaze, some distant incandescence called history, some history of which it turns out you are a part, some history to which you are responsible. I'm still thinking of the promises we made to each other. If they dare touch a hair on your head, I'll fight to the last breath. What should I do with those promises now? Okay, thank you.
So we're going to have time for a short Q&A. We have a microphone over here that I believe people can line up to if they would like. And I will get us started. I actually have a question for Jali. You are a historian, and you have chosen... assistant professor of history, and you've chosen a genre where you are changing history. How do you reconcile that?
It's funny you ask that. When I was when I was in grad school, doing my doctoral work, I'd always had an interest in alternate history and counterfactuals. And, as far as any professors I had who ever brought that up, it was just all nonsense, right? Counterfactuals had no place. And yet I find that it has a place. And then on the other hand, I think people sometimes approach it in ways that I don't. So, for instance, in this book, I got like a very long note from someone. People like to write you very long things about your book, in which they explained why it was implausible that Haiti could have become this power that I've pointed out. And so I had to put on my historian cap there and said, like, you know, basically, that's not the point. We can sit here and argue about which of these histories would be more correct, and we would get nowhere because none of them are correct. History is history. Everything else is made up. So I think I don't mind changing history because that's not the point for me, as I tried to explain to this person. The question for me is, when I look at any counterfactual, is what was changed and why? Why did the author, why did the creator, why did the filmmaker decide to make certain changes? That's what's important to me, because I think there is where many times the creator is trying to get at these silences or at these parts of history that they think need to be uplifted or changed or what have you. But as far as whether one counterfactual is more correct or than the other, that's all nonsense to me. Yeah.
Don't be shy. I believe we'll bring a mic to someone if they have a question. So all three of you, I'm curious about which came first. Was it the, I'm interested in this historical period, what if we made it fantasy? Or what was it that I'm interested in fairy tales, or I would like to write a story that's genderqueer, and then you found the historical time and place to do that? Who'd like to start?
In my case, I had always loved books based on fairy tales. I was a big fan of Robin McKinley growing up. If anybody's read her, yep, I'm seeing nods. And I'd been studying so much Russian and so many Russian-related things in the last few years before I wrote Baron Nightingale that I decided to do a book, based on a fairy tale, based on a Russian fairy tale. I loved Russian fairy tales. I still do. And I feel like they were a little bit underrepresented in the fairy tale book genre. So I start writing the fairy tale, and then I felt like it didn't have enough of a grounding. It felt very unmoored to me. It felt like a generic kind of Russian-esque fantasy world. And so to ground the book, I put it in a historical setting. I said, okay, I'll put it in the 14th century. And then use the history to inform the fairy tale and vice versa. I also wanted to use the time period to show a Russia that comes before all the things we think of as Russian. Like, the 14th century is before there were czars, before there were onion domes and troikas and samovars, and I don't even know, the Russian Empire, communism, like, all these things are in the future. And so it helps me, I hoped, to present a Russia free of stereotype and to come at the region in a different way. So that was my goal.
I'll try to answer that quickly. I study the early 18th century, British early 18th century, and I was interested in the figure of Jack Sheppard. He really was an extremely famous prison break artist. He had broken out of Newgate Prison and other prisons at least four times. He broke his girlfriend and partner in crime out of prison. And many historians had said, like, he was more famous, more regular people knew his name at the time than knew the name of the queen. Like, he was really this huge folk hero. And I was interested in him because I was interested in looking at a moment in time that was the birth of municipal policing in Britain, right? So Britain did not even the police are so naturalized, or they attempt to be naturalized to us now as if this needs to exist. But of course, London didn't even have a municipal police force until the later part of the 18th century. There were no police before that. So Jack Sheppard is in a way, or was in a way to me, a story about the intersection of one person who's resisting the imposition of laws around private property with the birth of the prison system as we know it now and the birth of the police. So I was really interested in that conjuncture. But when I looked at the archival materials, one of the things that had fallen out of a lot of the more famous retellings of his life, like Brecht's Three Penny Opera, was that a lot of the minor archival materials really described him as genderqueer, or what we would understand as genderqueer now. And so I basically thought it was time for a retelling. I could say more about that, but I'll pause on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, on the one hand, of course, I always have an interest in speculative fiction of various kinds, and I suppose, in fact, most of the speculative fiction I tend to do is fantasy, and so I would at times try to compartmentalize the historian part of me away from the speculative fiction part of me, and I basically stopped doing that and tried to find ways in which I could interpret history in different ways and through speculative meanings in order to explore it greater. And so in this case, the Black God's Drums comes about because the history I study happens to be the 18th century and 19th century Black Atlantic and slavery and emancipation. So, of course, I'm going to write a story that centers the Haitian Revolution, the seminal event in the Age of Revolutions that's often ignored or silenced in larger histories. And I decided that New Orleans was the place to set it because the city itself is a city that kind of that bridges so much of the various parts of the Atlantic world. And in my story, I really tried to create a New Orleans that is, while it's part of the United States, is also tethered, as it was historically, very much to the Caribbean region, very much to the Francophone Caribbean and other parts of the Caribbean. So it interacts in that sense. In fact, the person that Creeper is going to see is a West Indian smuggler, Captain Anne-Marie, who has a ship called the Midnight Robber, and anyone familiar with carnival tropes should know what a Midnight Robber is, right? So I tried to really bring all of this into this genre or subgenre that people talk about, such as steampunk, in a way to subvert the normal Victorian roles that tend to play a part in that genre, and also to use this counterfactual to imagine different power plays in history, right? In this history, you read the book, Haiti plays a very prominent role and is considered one of the powers of the Western Hemisphaire. And so I wanted people to imagine how something like that could play out. And in many ways, like any counterfactual, of course, in bringing up various elements of history that I do throughout the book, what I'm trying to get people to do is to actually look at our society, right? When you see these various elements within that I bring up, if you go and look them up, if you're inquisitive to find out where they come from, I think it may tell you a bit more about our own history, which is what the story in many ways is trying to get at.
So we are unfortunately just about out of time. I would like to remind you guys that I've read all three books. I personally vouch for them. They are amazing, and they are all for sale right outside here. And all three of our authors would be happy to personalize the books for you. So could we please hear another round of applause? Thank you so much for coming out.